Oh, I have a lot of questions that came out from what we talked about last time. And one of that had to do, now I forget his name. Mr. Shiro? Mr. Shiro.
Lucius Rogers Shiro.
Right. He was the... And you said two things that sort of I wanted to pursue. One, that he helped the college institute the honor system, right?
Well, he was one of the professors imported by Adelot when he became president and decided that he would make Swarthmore as much like an Oxford college as possible. And he very carefully chose people for each department where there was an opening. I suppose he couldn't just fire people because some of the old-timers lingered. But he got people who had themselves gone to Oxford or Cambridge or had the kind of background that he wanted here. One in Greek, Mr. Shiro, and one in Latin. And Mr. Shiro, he was a very gifted man in many ways. He played the organ for years. He played the organ for the college. He played the organ at commencement, and at we had what was known as collection every Thursday morning. Students were obliged to come to an hour's meeting. And there would be, sometimes it was just college business that everybody was supposed to know about, but very often it was a speaker from the outside. For example, Adelot himself, the only time I ever saw or heard him, he came to speak at collection. And we would do a lot of hymn singing. This was interesting to me. And many students objected to coming, and something was worked out by Courtney Smith, that if the students had what seemed to him to be a legitimate cause for not wanting to go to collection, they could be excused, but then they could never go to any other collection. If somebody was coming that they really wanted to hear, they couldn't come.
Oh,
so not a great many people took advantage of that.
So everybody went, basically.
Everybody went, yes. And the faculty did not by any means have to come. But again, in my first year or two, I found it very interesting because I, you know, I learned a lot, and I went, I would say about two-thirds of the time.
So they took attendance for the students? How did they work that out?
I beg your pardon?
They took attendances?
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. Somebody took attendance, and I don't know who it was. I've forgotten whether it was a job that was assigned to a student or whether somebody in the registrar's office was supposed to do it. But one of the first things that was got rid of after the end of the 60s, when things around here changed a great deal, was compulsory collection. Then for a while, it was used only for some special occasion, and then it just died out. Mm-hmm. Except they use the word collection quite a lot, and younger students don't know, you know, what it means. But I think they have a collection at alumni reunions or something like that. And that's once in a while, they will have it. I think they have something called First Collection, don't they? In the outdoor auditorium for the entering freshmen.
They're trying to reintroduce it, right? Didn't they?
Well, they have that Friday lunchtime spot is for, I think they call those collections. For example, for Martin Luther King's birthday, they have a gathering at lunch, and I think that's considered to be a collection. I don't know if it's conducted in any special way.
So,
well, I think the term itself is probably of Quaker origin, and if I knew more about the goings on in the meeting house, I might know the origin, but I don't.
But so what, in connection with Mr. Shiro, we were talking...
He played the organ.
Oh, he played the organ.
The other great thing that he did, that people have long since, of course, forgotten, he was a very gifted comic actor. And he and the man who was the chairman of the Greek department at Haverford in those days used to put on Greek plays, really Greek plays. I mean, they had to be in Greek. It wasn't simply a translation. And Lucius was really just terrific. Mm-hmm. And then in the faculty plays that I think I was talking about that we did every other year, he almost invariably had a part. And he was just, he had a great booming voice and wonderful diction and just had one of the best comic instincts that I ever saw. Mm-hmm. You never saw that in his teaching. This was not part of it at all, but it was part of his acting. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget his bringing down the house. We did a play once in which I happened to be I think I had the leading woman's role, and at a certain point, I was supposed to be eloping with, it was a college play, a member of the faculty, and Mr. Shiro played a member of the Board of Trustees, and he saw me coming across the stage with my suitcase, ready to elope. I was married to the hero, and he pulled himself up, and he said at the top of this booming voice, "What kind of a woman are you?" And that simply brought down the house, because the students, of course, knew us all and identified us with the roles and so on. But he was really marvelous.
So why didn't his teaching was not like that? I mean, was he popular among the students?
I don't think that it was anything except a sense of decorum. Uh-huh. And I was always interested in students' comments. One woman told me once, or some alumna, that it did her a great deal of good. But she was taking a course with him, and I think it was something like ancient history or Greek literature and translation or something. Our bread and butter courses. And she said that knowing that what he cared about was what he was teaching and not about the students was a very salutary thing for her. Mm-hmm. I don't know what her background was. I really never knew her very much. It may have been after he died that she told me that. But he was not a wildly popular teacher, but he was a very, very reliable person. Mm-hmm. And he spent a great deal of his time doing things that are never really acknowledged, because they're, on the whole, like I'm thinking of his reading manuscripts, both for books that were being published and especially for various publications, and he was one of the people that was completely relied on for that. Mm. And since nobody knows who reads these things usually, nobody said, "Isn't Lucius doing a great job?" Mm-hmm. I always felt that he didn't get the kind of gratitude that he deserved. And when they did a few years ago, that North American classicist book, did you ever run across that? I had the job of writing very short articles about several people. And I, of course, did the one about Lucius and put that in because I thought it was time he got. He wrote a wonderful historical account of the Philological Association. Mm-hmm. He was the president at one time, and before that he had been secretary treasurer, gone through the whole bit. So he's somebody who I think always deserved more credit than he ever got.
Right. One of the other things that you said that struck me is that there was a whole generation of people like that that maintained classics departments during the Depression.
Yes.
By doing more than their share, perhaps?
Well, not only that, but by teaching overloads. We always took that for granted in those days, even when things were better. But keeping the importance of a classics department a matter of common knowledge in a small college that otherwise might have got rid of the classics. I saw this in bigger institutions too, and I always, again, I thought these are people that we owe a lot to, and nobody really remembers them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're interested in something that is really quite funny, as I look back on it, quite early in my teaching here, things were hard for classics all over the country, and I kept worrying about our department. And for one thing, I proposed certain new courses that turned out to be extremely popular. Nobody had ever taught mythology as a course. And Lucius was a master of mythology. It was one of the things he knew the most about. So I got him to teach a course in mythology. And the time came when we alternated it with Greek literature and translation and so on. And things got a lot better. But the thing that I'd forgotten about this, and I wish I could remember more about it, because it's a kind of product of a particular period in our history. I thought that I was always aware that we needed to be known by the students, and it was to some extent a help that I was a head resident in dormitories for so many years, that people knew me in one context, if not in another. But I had several friends, as it happened, in the biology department at that time. And one of them, they were several of them, very distinguished biologists and published a lot, and their names were famous and so on. But they mentioned to me that their students did not do as well as they should have done on examinations to see whether they are fit to go into medical school. A lot of the kids did go on to medical school. And there was a part of the exam that everybody had to take in those days, that I think it no longer exists, that they didn't do very well because they just didn't know anything. And they couldn't even spell words. So a friend of mine and I, a friend who was in the biology department, devised a course that was open only to biology students who might be pre-med students. And it was not given for credit because I wasn't really capable of doing a good job, though I was interested in it. And it was about the history of science in the ancient world, so that they would know who made the great discoveries and hear their names and be able to spell a lot of words they hadn't spelled before. And it was listed, I think, in the catalog as Classics X because it wasn't for credit. But the students, of course, converted it to Classic Sex. And it was extremely well patronized because it was obligatory. The chairman of the department made them take this, and members of the biology department came and listened. And I did my best, and I learned a lot myself.
The members of the biology department came to listen?
Oh, yes. And they would point out to me very often when I was mispronouncing something or when I had misunderstood something. So it was a, as they say, a learning experience for us all. And I think that may have gone on for 2 or 3 years. And the department, the biology department, was quite happy because the grades the kids had in that particular section of the exam got to be notably better. And I even got a paper out of it that I read to a local classics association mm-hmm. and told them it was something we could all do.
Yeah. And right, that's really called outreach. Now they call it outreach.
If you were interested enough in, well, I was interested in the pre-Socratic philosophers. That's how it really got started. And I had worked with Fritz Solmsen, of course, who was interested in that kind of thing, and he had dictated a couple of his books to me when I was in graduate school. So I had to know how to spell names and so on. Well, we got to the point where I couldn't really spend the time anymore because we got more and more students coming, taking things like Greek Lit and Trans and mythology and so on.
So when you first came, there was no mythology? There were no courses in translation at all?
Oh, yes. Mr. Chereau regularly gave Greek literature in translation, mm-hmm. which he was very happy to shove off to me when I came, and I was very happy to do it. But it was obvious that there were many other possibilities mm-hmm. that we were not developing, and one of them, of course, was Latin literature in translation, which everybody agrees is very, very hard to do because Latin literature doesn't have the originality on the whole that Greek does. If no matter what kind of translation you're reading in Greek literature, the stuff is so new, mm-hmm. Not just for the students, but for the Greeks themselves, that it's always exciting. But both Mr. Chereau and Ms. Cobb said, no, that will never go over. So I said, just let me try it. And I did it for several years, and got the enrollment up to 30, which was quite good for us in those days. And in fact, one of the students who came to the 50th reunion had taken that course and remembered it, and said, she started to tell me, and I couldn't hear the rest of it because somebody else came, but she said, in that course I learned that what is important is what the teacher is interested in. And she said, in effect, we all knew that you didn't like Latin as well as you like Greek and so on, but you were doing this and you made it interesting and so on.
So where did you start? How did that start? Can you
describe it? We had complete control over what we gave. Mm-hmm. And we just decided that one year I would do Greek Lit in the fall and Latin Lit in the spring. And that left Lucius free to do ancient history. And that's why, of course, when Lucius retired, we got Martin. Mm-hmm. And although he was perfectly capable of doing any of the things, as you know, we just depended on him to build up the history component. Mm-hmm. And philosophy, too, of mm-hmm. course. So,
until when you say we, was there anyone else in the department?
Beg pardon?
Who was in the department? There was you and Lucius Chereau.
And then only Ms. Cobbs.
And Ms. Cobbs.
And she taught one course a semester if she had time. Ms. Cobbs was the dean of women who had a PhD from the University of Chicago. But she was hired as the dean. She loved teaching. And as I was saying last time, it's, you know, looking back on those days, I'm aware of how hard it was for people of her generation because there just were not enough jobs. There aren't enough jobs now, but there are a lot more. Mm. And the people at Chicago wrote back to her teachers. She went to Randolph-Macon. She was a Southerner. And they said, that Miss Cobbs of yours, she knows everything. And she really did. But she had very little chance to teach, mm-hmm. one course a semester. But she did a great job. She loved Plautus, which nobody else did at that point. So she filled in a need too. And then gradually we were able to persuade the president that we had something that enough students wanted. I mean, he would never, I think, have done away with the classics department. Neither of the first two presidents that I knew. They were themselves, you know, people of very good judgment about what was important. But they couldn't give us additional help unless we proved that we had the enrollment. And for several years, I worked very hard on that. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, the students were wonderfully responsive.
So it's nothing new that classics has to struggle to stay alive.
Oh, no. It's always been a struggle.
But the classics department at Swarthmore must have been instituted when the institution first began, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And but it never was a large department.
Right.
And people, I think, didn't really begin to take the classics very seriously until things got a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. But Courtney Smith was always a very, very cautious person. And when it began to seem to him likely that we could survive if we had a third full-time person, mm-hmm. rather than two people with Susan whenever she could help us. But to test this, he said we could have a visiting professor and see how things went. And God was merciful to us. What we got was Russell Meigs.
Mm-hmm. He was the first visiting professor?
Yes.
How did that go?
How did it go?
Yes.
Oh, it went wonderfully. We had him for just one semester. Actually, he was the third person that we invited. I didn't know anything about Russell Meigs. I may have heard the name. In fact, I'm sure I did. But I had some other ideas and got polite letters of refusal from them. And then we went to Russell. And he was adventurous and decided to do it. And he came early in January in those days, as in the days when I was telling you about the faculty plays. We had that time between Christmas and the beginning of the second semester, which wasn't until February. So he came early, and we had a very snowy winter. Martin didn't know him either. We were both so nervous. I remember we went in to 30th Street to meet him. He got that far on the train himself, and we picked him up and brought him back to my apartment and took it from there. Well, he borrowed swimming trunks from a member of the philosophy department who was not nearly as big as Russell was. And he went snow, well, what would we call it? He popularized the sport of rolling in the snowbanks. And
in swimming trunks?
Yes. Just in swimming trunks. And it happened to be, as I say, a winter when we had, well, we probably had as much snow as we had this last winter, and great banks of snow. And you would see Russell rolling around in a snowbank. And the students who were preparing for their exams were only too happy to have something divert them. And they stood around and watched the new classics professor. And then they went and got their own bathing suits. And they did it. And for a whole month, that was the vogue in Swarthmore. To roll around in the snow.
Roll around in the sense the way you roll downhill horizontally? Or no, you roll around?
You plunge into the snowbank. Okay. And you roll around in it.
Uh-huh. So that was that only that one year?
He never did it again, as far as I remember. We had him four times. He was such a tremendous success. And a couple of times we had him for a full year. But the first time and the last time, I think we had him for one semester. It was all he could spare. But it was here that he finished his Ostia book that he had been working on for many, many, many years. And he was such a devoted teacher. I think this was his reputation at Balliol. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he was master of Balliol or something of the sort and had a lot to do with running the college and so on. He really gave everything to Balliol. But when he got a chance to be on leave, of course, like the rest of us, he would get some work done. And the first thing that he worked on was the book on Ostia. He finished that here. His second book, for which he is, I think, even better known, is the one on Athenian politics in the 5th century. And he wrote that almost entirely here.
The Athenian Empire?
Beg pardon?
The one on the Athenian Empire?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's...
And then in his last year, he was working on, he'd begun working, he hadn't really finished it here, the book on trees and timber in the ancient world, which is a marvelous book. I remember visiting him once when I was visiting Oxford, and I didn't really see what the point was. So we were on the bus coming in to Oxford, and he started telling me what he was going to do in every single chapter. And, you know, I realized how essential a look this gave us into Roman history in all sorts of ways. So that he largely did here, but was still working on just the year he became ill and died.
But when he first came, Martin must have not been here for very long, was it?
No, he was here for only one semester. And he was Courtney's trial to see if we could... what we were pushing, really, was ancient history.
Right.
And that was his field, or one of his many fields. And he had enormous classes. He taught a seminar, and he taught a class for students that were not interested in the seminar or couldn't take it. And he also did something which was much appreciated by the students. He had breakfast, in fact, most of his meals, in the college dining room, and would welcome students to come and sit with him. And he was always willing to listen to their troubles and to give them advice. He was the most sympathetic person you could imagine. And he just did us a powerful lot of good. And after that semester, the spring semester, that he was with us, Courtney said, okay, go ahead, get your number three.
Mm. But how long had Martin been there by then?
Well, my memory is not very good for that. Martin came in 58, and it was sometime in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. That Russell came. The second year, the second time he came, Paula, his wife, came, was a very interesting person herself, who was an English historian and published a book on Charles II. and was much respected by the history department here, who, as I think I told you, tended to be afraid of Russell because he was just bringing people in. And I mean, it wasn't just a popular thing. It was something that was extremely solid.
But how is it possible that somebody who arrives new is such a magnet immediately for the students?
That somebody could do what?
That somebody can just have big classes after arriving only for one semester.
Well,
because he was famous.
If you were rolling in the snow for a month, and everybody knew you, and everybody talked about you, and the student newspaper ran articles about you, everybody was eager to take courses with you, and they did. And he took all comers. He was a
year the new guy.
So you're the rolling in the snow.
That's not my thing. No.
No, but he really... he did us an enormous amount of good and opened up horizons for the faculty as well as for the students.
So then after that, you could just hire the third person?
Yes.
And who came?
He was absolutely wonderful. He had been at Harvard... And then he went to Cornell, and he worked on Latin literature and on Roman history, mainly. Well, I'm so ashamed of myself not to be able to remember his name, because how he grieved when he left us. He went to Brandeis, and then he became provost at University of California. One of the universities of California in Los Angeles, and died at his desk. And we always said that if he had stayed here, he wouldn't have died like that. But actually, his father had died in the same way and at the same, just about the same age. Isn't this terrible? Think of people that you could remember from that generation. It's just absolutely gone.
We'll give him proper Kleos.
Beg pardon?
We will give him proper Kleos.
Oh, absolutely.
So, but what was he working on?
What
was his specialty?
His specialty? He was working on I know that it was Latin literature of the Empire, and he did some work on Augustine also. He had done a lot of work on medieval Latin, and when he took the job at Cornell, we offered him a job. Because by then we knew we could have our third person. But Cornell was a place where he could teach graduate students, of course, and that was the big attraction. And he himself had been there after he finished at Harvard. But I shouldn't say exactly 6 months later, but at the meeting... It was in Baltimore, as I remember, that year, at the Christmas meeting of the Philological Association. He came up to me and said, "Miss North, I've made a terrible mistake. Could I still come to Swarthmore?" So, of course, I embraced him.
Oh.
And he just couldn't stand the weather anymore.
Oh.
By this time, he was married, and I think his wife didn't like the winters in Ithaca. But we were delighted to have him under any circumstances, and we had him for 3 or 4 years. He was he taught Latin to Carolyn in her freshman year. And we were talking about him when she was here. Isn't that terrible? We're both having trouble remembering names, and we fastened on him.
So, and then after that, he went where? Went to Stanford, you said?
He went to Brandeis.
To Brandeis. To
His wife was a Brandeis alumna.
Uh-huh.
And he did that for several years. But Brandeis, of course, never had an endowment. Mm-hmm. They depended entirely every year on donations.
Mm-hmm.
And when there would be crises in Israel, that's where the patrons gave their money. And after struggling with that for a couple of years, he said, I just couldn't stand it anymore,
mm-hmm.
having to raise money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he got then this offer at UCLA,
mm-hmm.
and did a wonderful job. He's a very, very judicious, very kind person.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to Carolyn talk about him, you'll see how much... She wrote, in fact, when he died, a beautiful obituary for him, which she gave to me and which I tried to get published in the alumni magazine, but it was too long.
Mm-hmm.
Do it. But he was our number two. And then he, like Russell, and of course like Martin, had been so successful that the classics department became more prominent. And the next thing we were able to do was to get not only number three, but number four.
Mm-hmm.
And we got Tom Mitchell and Gil Rose.
All right. Also, Tom Mitchell, let's talk about Tom Mitchell. How long was he here for?
He was here for 10 years.
Oh.
And he had been, I had known him not very much, but I knew him at Cornell. He had done his graduate work. All of it, I think. Did he get a... he had gone to the University of Galway when it was new, one of their first Latinists, and did brilliantly. And then he wanted to study with Solmsen. But he had the bad luck to come to Cornell the year that Solmsen left. Solmsen went to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom stayed on and had a very distinguished career there. It was where he met Lynn, his wife. She's a girl from New Jersey who was in one of the sciences, but she was very gifted at drawing, and she used to do drawings for people in the sciences and so on. And they got married while they were there, and they had their first child when they came here.
Mm-hmm.
And we got Tom for 1 year because he already, when he got his doctorate at Cornell, had an offer from the University College Cork, and he had accepted that, but it wasn't until the next year. So we got him here for a year. We had a great time, you know, getting people and trying to keep them and so on. And sometimes we were very lucky. Tom was here the first, just that 1 year, and then he left. And I remember that year very well because it was the year that my mother died. I'd come home from Rome. And when I was able to go back to Rome, late in the spring, I stopped in Ireland for a week. And I went down to Cork to visit. And Tom said, Helen, I made a terrible mistake. Could I come back? Well, I don't know how we were so lucky as to have vacancies when we needed them. But I think that there was some kind of power watching over us that we made only very temporary appointments on those occasions. If we couldn't get the person we wanted, very, very much. We didn't settle on anybody else. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I welcomed him with open arms, and then he came, and he was here for, you know, for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And he developed our Latin program and our history program very, very well. It was his idea, and I think Gill's, who came the year after he did, to offer a beginning Latin course that required more courses, more classes, but gave you more credit and so on, and that took hold.
Or the 1.5 credit tradition?
Yes. So that spread to other language departments, too. It was a very good idea. And Tom was, he was also the kind of person who has a great impact on the faculty. He very quickly, it's always noticeable, was appointed to various committees, mm-hmm. and was doing all sorts of things. I, in fact, began to be afraid that he might go into administration. Mm-hmm. But luckily, as long as he was with us, he was teaching. I can see him now down at the front of Parish Hill teaching football to little boys. They had 3 little boys before they left here, and they were a couple who were very, very influential on the faculty. But the time came when not Cork, but Trinity College had an opening, and Tom went to be invited to be studied in very great detail. My, they really wanted to know an awful lot about him, but they offered him the job. And I knew at once that he was leaving us, because I was in my office in Parrish the day he got back, and he came leaping up the stairs, and he handed me a brown paper bag with a bottle in it. And I opened the bag, and it was a bottle of Pachin. Mm-hmm. Now, do you all know what Pachin is?
I don't.
Pachin is Irish whiskey, but it's illegally made, and it's notorious because it is so so powerful. And Tom had a sister whose husband had a traveling grocery store in County Mayo, and he used to make trips all through the hills, and the people who made Pachin.
How do you spell
him?
That?
P-O-T-C-H-E-E-N.
It's an Irish word. It's something made in a pot.
Oh.
Pot whiskey. They're called Pachin. When I opened it, looked in, and I saw it was actually a rum bottle that had been reused for Pachin. And I said, Tom, does this mean what I think it means? And he said, yes, I've got the job.
Oh.
So off they went.
So it was bittersweet.
Yeah. And about 5 years later, he became provost of Trinity, which was election by the faculty. It's very, very hard to get. Mm-hmm. And he held that office for 10 years. And he's now retired as provost, but he is doing all sorts of things. He runs, he's in charge of the, oddly enough, the best teaching hospital in Dublin, which belongs to Trinity, and he has been reorganizing it and so on, and doing all sorts of things. So he was a great addition, he and Gill, at the same time, and I remember, again, very well, when they were up for tenure. And, you know, the college was still smaller, and we knew people. And I had an office on the second floor in Parrish, and there was a ladies' room at the far end of Parrish. And when I walked down to go to the ladies' room, either the president or the vice president would very often have his door open. Mm-hmm. and call me in to tell me something, or sometimes ask me something. But Ed Kratzley was the vice president then, and he said, you can't have them both tenured. You've got to choose.
Wow.
And I said, no, I won't choose. I didn't choose, so we got them both.
Oh, I cannot believe that they told you something. Mm-hmm. Because obviously it had nothing to do with the merit of the people. It had to do with...
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Things were done quite informally.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny that Ed Kratzley, I mean, the financial vice president, it's odd that he would be involved.
You know, it may have been the year after Courtney died. I think maybe it was.
So he was acting president.
Because he was sitting in, I think, that Open Doors, I picture it, was Courtney's office. Because I'd seen Courtney carried out on the stretcher the day that he died, and held the door for the stretcher bearers to...
Oh, he just died on the job? Suddenly?
He had a stroke when the admissions office had been occupied, and we were having for about, let's see, several weeks we had daily or nightly faculty meetings, and I happened to be secretary of something or other, so that I was the one who recorded things. And Courtney said at one point, I'm not going to have faculty meetings that go on until 2 in the morning because it's so hard on the older members of the faculty. And in fact, a number of older members had stopped coming because it was just too tiring. And the only one who died was Courtney himself.
Mm-hmm. And these were meetings to discuss what was to be done about the student occupation?
About the demands that it's too complicated to be to go into here and not really very relevant, I suppose, to us. But Frank Pearson had been the chairman of a committee which presented a recommendation to the faculty specifically about increasing the number of African American students. And he presented that early in December. And when the admissions office was occupied, of course, people from off campus. They presented a demand, set of demands, which were almost identical with the ones in Frank's proposal. And it was the same day that they also occupied the admissions office in Brandeis, making it look very much as though two extremely liberal colleges had been made the victims of this. And what to do to satisfy these people and to do it in the way the college thought should be done, that was what we were talking about. I remember I used to feed Courtney bars of, there was a chocolate bar called Irish Coffee that you could get only in Ireland. It was so good. And Mary and I always got some when we came back, and I had some, and I used to feed it to poor old Courtney. And it was my job to write on the board, the blackboard, the things that were being discussed and so on. And that was quite a time.
And so he felt sick while this meeting was going on?
Big bite.
He felt sick while this meeting was going on?
Yes.
Oh,
no, well, we were having the meetings in the evening.
Right.
And he was in his office in the morning. Uh-huh. I was, in fact, meeting a student in my office, and the phone rang, and it was somebody telling me that Courtney had just had a heart attack mm-hmm. or a stroke. They didn't know what, and to come, simply because I was on all these committees. So I went to his office, and he was already dead. And I don't mean to harrow you all, but it's harrowing to think of it. I remember standing there in the corridor, and as I say, they brought him out in a stretcher, and they covered him with a blanket so we knew that he had died. And I held the door open for them to get out, the second floor of Parrish, and looked down, could see at the top of Courtney's head all the hair that had turned gray in recent years, not just this occasion, but and then Susan Cobbs and Ed Kratzy and I stood there, and Susan and I, of course, were crying our eyes out, and poor Ed Kratzy, he would pat Susan on the shoulders, and then he would pat me on the shoulders, he'd pat Susan, pat me, and so on. It's in a way funny to think of it after that. And then we had a meeting in the Quaker meeting. And we then had a Catholic chaplain. And he said Mass there for Courtney. Mm-hmm. And everybody went to communion. Mm-hmm. People who, you know, who were practically no Catholics.
Mm-hmm. Was Courtney Catholic?
But
Courtney yeah. Smith was Catholic?
Beg pardon?
Was Courtney Smith Catholic?
No, no.
Oh, so why? So.
Because this was a way of doing honor uh-huh. to Courtney. Uh-huh. And the Quakers were... He had become a Quaker after he took the presidency mm-hmm. here. Not the first year, but he did become a Quaker. But they had nothing to offer at that point. And whoever we had roped in as a chaplain came and said Mass, mm-hmm. and I remember marveling, seeing all these people, you know, going up to mm-hmm. receive communion. So, it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Courtney did a great deal for us, but he was a man that was hard to persuade. But once he agreed, he would stick with you, and not expect unreasonable results. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. let things go on. Mm. And I think his help had a great deal to do with the growth of our department, because he made everything as easy for us as he could, you know, financially. Mm-hmm. And he himself, of course, had been to Oxford. He was in charge of the Oxford or the Rhodes Scholarship Program, and he knew Russell or knew about Russell, and to get him here was, I saw later a real triumph for him, mm-hmm. and to make Swarthmore something that was so important in Russell's life. In fact, I read an obituary of Russell after he died, which spoke particularly of how beloved he was at Swarthmore and how much he enjoyed being here, that he came again and again and again. It wasn't just a temporary affection.
So do you think that the connection of Swarthmore to Oxford was especially true in the case of classics?
And Greek.
Yes, I mean, in the case of Greek and Latin. I mean, it was not like
Mr. Chereau, of course, had been to Oxford. He was, a Rhodes Scholar. I don't think Miss Brewster had actually been to Oxford, but she studied in England and in Rome and so on. She was a person of a good deal of experience, though she started out in Bryn Mawr. And I think that though I never heard this discussed at all, it would have been a shame on the part of Swarthmore if it had done away with the classics. Mm. And it never was even suggested. It was just my my own concerns because I saw this happening all around and not just then. But we really had some strong supporters. And, of course, Miss Cobbs was a great help. Also.